Leviathan, Part 2, Commonwealth, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 27 and 28. Chapter 27, Crimes, Excuses, and Extenuations. Not only is every breach of a law a sin, but so also is any contempt of the legislator, that is, any disregard for the legislator, treating him as negligible. For such contempt is a breach of all his laws at once. So it may consist not only in doing or saying something that the laws forbid, or not doing what the law commands, but also in intending to break a law. For that, too, is somewhat contemptuous of the person whose role it is to ensure that the law is obeyed. That is a point about intending, not about imagining. The law that says, "Thou shalt not covet," is not broken when you take delight in merely imagining owning another man's goods, servants, or wife, without intending to take them from him by force or fraud. Again, suppose there is someone from whose life you expect nothing but damage and displeasure. For you to take pleasure in imagining or dreaming of his death isn't a sin, though it would be sinful for you to decide to do something that would be likely to bring about his death. Enjoying the mere thought of something that you would enjoy if it were real, that is a passion so bound up with the nature of man, and of every other living creature, that if it were a sin, then being a man would be a sin. This line of thought has led me to think that some moralists have been too severe, both to themselves and others, in maintaining that the first motions of the mind, though restrained by the fear of God, can be sins. But I admit it's safer to err in that way than in the opposite direction. A crime is a sin that consists in doing or saying something that the law forbids, or not doing something that the law has commanded. Thus, every crime is a sin, but not every sin is a crime. To intend to steal or kill is a sin, even if it never shows up in words or deeds. For God, who sees the thoughts of a man, can charge him with having such an intention. But until it appears in something done or said, providing evidence of intention that could be put before a human judge, it isn't called a crime. From this relation of sin to the law, and of crime to the civil law, three things can be inferred. First, that where law ceases, sin ceases. But the law of nature cannot cease, because it is eternal. So violation of covenants, ingratitude, arrogance, and all acts contrary to any moral virtue, can never cease to be sin. Secondly, that where civil law ceases, crimes cease. This is because in the absence of civil law, the only law remaining is the law of nature. So there's no place for accusation, every man being his own judge, accused only by his own conscience, and cleared only by the uprightness of his own intention. When his intention is right, his act in having it is no sin. If his intention is wrong, his having it is sin, but not crime. Thirdly, when the sovereign power ceases, crime also ceases. For where there is no such power, there is no protection to be had from the law, and therefore everyone may protect himself by his own power. But this applies only to those who haven't contributed to the taking away of the sovereign power that protected them, for that was a crime from the beginning. The source of every crime is some defect of the understanding, or some error in reasoning, or some sudden force of the passions. I shall discuss these in turn. Defect in the understanding is ignorance, which is of three sorts: of the law, of the sovereign, and of the penalty. Ignorance of the law of nature excuses no man, because every adult is supposed to know that he ought not to do to anyone else something he would not want to have done to himself. Therefore, wherever a man comes from, if he does anything contrary to that law, it is a crime. If a man comes here from India, and persuades men here to accept a new religion, or teaches them anything that is likely to get them to disobey the laws of this country, however sure he is of the truth of his teaching, he commits a crime, and can justly be punished for it. Not only because his doctrine is false, but also because he is doing something that he would not agree to being done by someone who entered his country and tried to alter the religion there. But ignorance of the civil law excuses a man in a foreign country until the law has been declared to him, because no civil law is binding on a man until it has been declared to him. Similarly, if the civil law of a man's own country has not been declared well enough for him to be able to know it, ignorance of the civil law is a good excuse for an action which breaks that law, but not the law of nature. Otherwise, ignorance of the civil law is not an effective excuse. Ignorance of the sovereign power in the country where a man ordinarily lives is not an excuse, because he ought to be aware of the power that has been protecting him there. When the law has been declared, ignorance of the penalty excuses no man. Here is why. If a law were not accompanied by fear of a penalty for breaking it, it wouldn't be a law, but mere pointless words. So when a man breaks the law, he accepts the penalty, even though he doesn't know what it is. Because anyone who voluntarily performs an action accepts all the known consequences of it, and in every commonwealth punishment is a known consequence of the violation of the laws. If the punishment is already determined by the law, the lawbreaker is subject to that. If it isn't, then he is subject to punishment chosen in this case by the relevant authority. For it is reasonable that someone who does wrong, with no restraint except whatever is set by his own will, should be punished with no restraint, except whatever is set by the will of the sovereign whose law he has violated. But when a penalty has been assigned to the crime in the law itself, or has usually been inflicted in similar cases, then the delinquent is excused from a greater penalty. For if the foreknown punishment wasn't severe enough to deter men from the action, it was an encouragement to perform it. Because when men weigh what they'll gain from acting wrongly against what they'll suffer from punishment, they choose what appears best for themselves, making this choice by the necessity of nature. So when they are punished more than the law had formerly determined, or more than others had been punished for the same crime, it is the law that tempted them, and, it now turns out, deceived them. No law made after an action was performed can turn it into a crime, because a positive law can't be attended to before it is made, and so it can't be obligatory before it is made. If the action was a breach of the law of nature, the law was in force before the action was performed. Defective reasoning, that is, error, makes men prone to violate the laws in three ways. Firstly, by presumption of false principles. For example, men observe how in all countries and at all times unjust actions have been authorized by the force and the victories of those who have committed them, that powerful men have broken through the cobweb laws of their country, and that the only ones regarded as criminals have been men of the weaker sort, and ones who have failed in their enterprises. And they are led by these observations to accept as principles, and as premises for their reasoning, that justice is only an empty word. Whatever a man can get by his own labour and risk-taking is his own. Something that all nations do can't be unjust. Examples from earlier times are good arguments for doing the same again, and many more of that kind. If these are accepted, no act can be a crime in itself. For an act to be a crime, it would have to be made to be one, not by the law, but by the outcome of it for those who commit it. Secondly, by false teachers who either misinterpret the law of nature in a way that makes it conflict with the civil law, or present doctrines of their own or traditions of earlier times that are inconsistent with the duty of a subject, and teach them as laws. Thirdly, by erroneous inferences from true principles. This commonly happens when men hastily rush to conclusions about what to do. For example, men who have a high opinion of their own understanding, and believe that things of this nature, practical decisions in concrete situations, don't require time and study, but only common experience and a good natural intelligence, which everyone thinks he has. In contrast with that, the theoretical knowledge of right and wrong is no more difficult than practical knowledge of what to do in concrete situations, yet no man will claim to have it without great and long study. None of those defects in reasoning can excuse, though some may extenuate, a crime by any man who claims to be managing his own affairs, much less by one who undertakes a public charge, because in claiming to manage something, they claim to have reason, and cannot base an excuse on their supposed lack of it. One of the passions that most frequently cause crime is vainglory, a foolish overrating of one's own worth, as though worth were an effect of intelligence or wealth or lineage, or some other natural quality, not depending on the will of those who have the sovereign authority. From vainglory comes a presumption that the punishments set by the laws, and extended generally to all subjects, ought not to be inflicted on them, the vainglorious ones, as rigorously as they are on poor, obscure, and simple men. And so it comes about, often, that people who value themselves on the basis of how wealthy they are, embark on crimes, hoping to escape punishment by corrupting public justice, or obtaining pardon by money or other rewards. And those who have many powerful relatives, and popular men who have gained a reputation amongst the multitude, are encouraged to violate the laws, by their hope of overcoming, by sheer weight of numbers, the power whose job it is to enforce them. And people with a great, and false, opinion of their own wisdom, take it on themselves to criticise the actions and question the authority of those who govern. They make speeches that unsettle the laws, to the point where nothing is to count as a crime unless their purposes require it to be so. These same men are apt to commit any crime that involves skill and the deception of their neighbours, because they think their schemes are too subtle to be detected. These, I repeat, are effects of a false presumption of one's own wisdom. But of those who start the disturbance of commonwealth, which can never happen without a civil war, very few are left alive long enough to see their new plans established, so that the benefit of their crimes comes to posterity, and to those who would least have wanted it, which shows that the instigators of the disturbance were not as wise as they thought they were. As for those who try to deceive others in the hope of not being observed, they often deceive only themselves, the darkness in which they believe they lie hidden being nothing but their own blindness, and are no wiser than children who think they can hide everything by closing their own eyes. Vainglorious men, unless they are also timid, are all subject to anger, because they are more likely than other people to interpret ordinary conversational freedom as disrespect, and there are few crimes that anger can't produce. As for the passions of hate, lust, ambition, and covetousness, what crimes they are apt to produce are so obvious to every man's experience and understanding that I needn't say anything about them, except that those passions are so firmly tied to the nature of man and other living creatures that their criminal effects can only be hindered by an extraordinary use of reason or constant severity in punishing them. For in the things that men hate, they find a continual and unavoidable annoyance, so that a man's only alternative to everlasting patience is the removal of the power of whatever it is that annoys him. Patience is difficult, and the removal of the annoyance is often impossible without violating some law. Ambition and covetousness are passions that are also constantly present and pressing, whereas reason is not constantly present to resist them. So they have their effects in possibly criminal behaviour, as soon as there's some hope of getting away with it. As for lust, what it lacks in durability, it makes up for in violent strength, which suffices to outweigh any fear of punishment, when the punishment is mild or is not certain to come. The passion that least inclines men to break the laws is fear. Indeed, fear is the only thing that deters men from breaking the laws, when it seems that profit or pleasure would come from breaking them. Some men are exceptions to this, ones with noble natures, although fear often deters from crime, in many cases it can lead to crime. That would not be so if fear were always a justifying excuse, so that an action committed out of fear never counted as a crime. But that is not how things stand. For not every fear justifies the action it produces. The only kind that does is what we call bodily fear, fear of bodily hurt from which a man can't see how to escape except by an action that would otherwise be criminal. A man is assaulted, fears immediate death, and can't see how to escape except by wounding the assailant. If he wounds him fatally, this is no crime, because in the making of a commonwealth no man abandons the defence of his life or limbs, in situations where the law can't arrive in time to help him. But to kill a man, because his threats give me evidence that he will kill me when he can, that is a crime, because in this case I have time and means to ask for protection from the sovereign power. One citizen hears from another words full of insult, which nevertheless are not punishable by any law, and, fearing that unless he avenges himself by arms, he will be considered timid, he provokes his enemy to combat and kills him. This is a crime, and isn't excused by fear of this kind. Why? Because the Commonwealth wills that public words, that is, laws, count for more with citizens than the words of a private citizen, to whose words it has therefore made no effort to attach a penalty. It holds that those who cannot even tolerate words are the most cowardly of all men. A man who is afraid of spirits, either through his own superstition or through credulously believing other men who tell him of their strange dreams and visions, may be made to believe that spirits will hurt him if he obeys the law, and his action in disobeying it is a crime, and isn't to be excused by his fear of spirits. For dreams are naturally just the fancies that remain in sleep from the impressions that our senses had taken in when we were awake. And some visions are really only dreams. A man may, for some reason, not be sure that he has been asleep, so he has had what seemed to him to be real visions. Someone who presumes to break the law on the strength of his own or someone else's dream or purported vision, or of any idea of the power of invisible spirits, other than ideas permitted by the Commonwealth, departs from the law of nature, which is certainly an offence, and he follows the imagery of his own, or some other private man's brain, of which he can never know whether it signifies something or nothing, or whether the other person who reported his own dream was telling the truth. By the law of nature, if any private man were permitted to do this, then everyone should be permitted. But in that case, no law could be made to hold, and so the Commonwealth would be completely dissolved. From these different sources of crimes, it's already clear that the ancient Stoics were wrong in saying that all crimes are fundamentally the same, as well as excuses through which what seemed to be a crime turns out not to be one. There is extenuation, through which what seemed to be a great crime becomes a lesser one. All crimes equally deserve the name of injustice, just as all deviation from a straight line is equally crookedness, as the Stoics rightly observed. But it doesn't follow that all crimes are equally unjust, any more than that all crooked lines are equally crooked. The Stoics, not seeing this, held it to be as great a crime to kill a hen illegally as to kill one's father. What totally excuses an action, making it not a crime, has to be something that takes away the obligation of the law. If an agent is obliged by the law, his act performed against the law simply is a crime. The lack of means to know the law totally excuses, because a law that a man has no way of learning about is not binding on him. But lack of diligence in inquiring into the civil law does not count as a lack of means. As for the laws of nature, no man who claims to have reason enough to manage his own affairs can be supposed to lack means to know the laws of nature, because they are known by the reason he claims to have. Only children and madmen are excused from offences against the natural law. where a man, through no fault of his own, is a captive of an enemy, or when his means of living is in the power of the enemy, the civil law no longer binds him. He must obey his enemy or die, and consequently such obedience isn't a crime. For no man is forbidden to protect himself as best he can when the protection of the law fails. If the terror of immediate death forces a man to do something against the law, he is totally excused, because no law can oblige a man to abandon his own preservation. Even if such a law were binding, the man could reason thus: if I don't do it, I shall die right now. If I do it, I shall die later through being put to death for this crime. So by doing it, I gain some lengthening of my life, and nature therefore insists that he act. When a man lacks food or some other necessity of life, and can't preserve himself in any way except by some illegal act, for example, in a great famine he takes by force or stealth the food that he can't buy and won't be given, or in defence of his life he snatches away another man's sword, he is totally excused, for the reason I have just given. Suppose the man or assembly that has the sovereign power disclaims some right that is essential to the sovereignty, thereby giving to the subject some liberty inconsistent with the sovereign power, that is, inconsistent with the very being of a commonwealth. If the subject exercises such a liberty, he sins and acts contrary to the duty of a subject. For all subjects ought to know what is and what isn't consistent with the right of the commonwealth, because the commonwealth was instituted by the individual subjects for their own well-being and by the consent of each one. And he ought also to know that this newly given liberty, in so far as it is inconsistent with the sovereignty, was granted only because the one who gave it was ignorant, and didn't see what dangers it posed to the commonwealth. But if the subject, as he proceeds to use that liberty, resists a public minister, that is not just a sin, but a crime. Degrees of criminality are measured on different scales, by the wickedness of the frame of mind that was the source or cause of the act, by how likely it is to set a bad example, by how bad its consequences were, and by various facts about times, places, and persons involved in the crime. An illegal act is a greater crime if it comes from the criminal's thinking his strength, riches, or friends are strong enough to resist the officers of the law, than if it comes from a mere hope of not being discovered or of escaping by flight. For the presumption of impunity through force is a root from which grows, at all times and with all temptations, a disregard for all laws, whereas in the latter case the apprehension of danger that makes a man flee also makes him more obedient in the future. An action that the person knows to be a crime is a greater crime than the same act coming from a false conviction that it is lawful. For he who commits it against his own conscience is relying on his force or some other power which encourages him to commit the same crime again. But he who commits it in error will, once he has been shown his error, be obedient to the law. Someone whose error comes from the authority of a publicly authorized teacher or interpreter of the law is not as much at fault as someone whose error comes from an obstinate pursuit of his own principles and reasoning. For on one hand, anything taught by a publicly authorized teacher is really taught by the commonwealth itself, and is something like a law, until the same authority finds fault with it. And any crime that doesn't involve denying the sovereign power, and isn't against an evident law, is totally excused by coming from such a source. Whereas, on the other hand, someone who bases his actions on his own private judgment ought to stand or fall according to whether the actions are right or wrong. An act of a kind that has been constantly punished in other men is a greater crime than it would be if many previous offenders had escaped punishment. For those examples are hopes of impunity that the sovereign himself has given. And because he who encourages a man to offend by giving him a hope and a presumption of mercy has a part in the offence himself, so he can't reasonably charge the offender with the whole of it. A crime arising from a sudden passion is not as great as it would have been if it had arisen from long meditation, for in the former case the common infirmity of human nature provides a basis for extenuation, whereas someone who acts with premeditation has been circumspect. He has looked at the law, the punishment, and the consequences for human society of his crime, and in going ahead with it he has belittled all this and made it secondary to his own appetite. Still, no suddenness of passion suffices for a total excuse, for all the time between the man's first learning the law and his commission of the crime should be regarded as time for deliberation, because he ought to be continually engaged in correcting the lawlessness of his passions through meditation on the law. If the law is often read and interpreted to all the people, a breach of it is a greater crime than it would be if men were given no such help, and had to take time out from their ordinary lives to investigate the law, putting in hard work with uncertain results, and learning about the law from people with no official standing. For in this latter case, part of the fault can be attributed to ordinary human limits, whereas in the former case there is evident negligence, which involves a disrespectful attitude to the sovereign power. Acts that the law explicitly condemns, but the lawmaker tacitly approves, as shown by other clear signs of his will, are lesser crimes than those same acts would be if they were condemned by both the law and lawmaker. For the will of the lawmaker is itself a law. So in this case, two contradictory laws have shown up, and that would totally excuse the act if men were obliged to attend to the sovereign's approvals, as shown by evidence other than his explicit commands. All they are obliged to attend to, however, are the explicit commands, so they are not totally excusable if they flout a command, and instead follow the sovereign's will, as shown implicitly in some other way. But because punishments can flow not only from breaking this sovereign's law, but also, as I shall show in a moment, from observing it, the sovereign is a partial cause of the crime, and therefore can't reasonably blame the whole crime on the criminal. For example, the law condemns duels, and makes dueling an offence punishable by death. On the other hand, someone who refuses a duel to which he has been challenged is exposed to contempt and scorn, for which he has no legal remedy, and in some cases will be thought by the sovereign himself to be unworthy to have any command or promotion in war. Now, all men lawfully try to obtain the good opinion of those who have the sovereign power. So if someone accepts the challenge to a duel, it isn't reasonable that he should be rigorously punished, seeing that part of the fault can be laid at the door of the punisher. I say this not because I support liberty of private revenges, or any other kind of disobedience, but to urge governors not to allow, in an indirect way, anything that they directly forbid. The examples the princes set have always had more power to govern people's actions than the laws themselves. And although it's our duty to do what they say, not what they do, that duty won't ever be performed until it pleases God to use extraordinary and supernatural grace to enable men to rise above their limitations. The third of the four bases I mentioned for measuring the severity of a crime involved comparing crimes by the amount of harm they cause. A criminal act that does damage to many people is a worse crime than it would have been if it had hurt only a few. And one aspect of this brings in the second of the four bases, because one way of doing harm is by setting a bad example. If an action does harm not only in the present, but also, by the example it sets, in the future, it's a greater crime than it would have been if it had done harm only in the present. That is because the former is a fertile crime, and multiplies to bring hurt to many, whereas the latter is barren. To maintain doctrines contrary to the religion established in the Commonwealth is a greater fault in an authorized preacher than it is in a private person, and the same applies to living profanely or licentiously, or performing any irreligious act. Likewise, maintaining an opinion or performing an act that tends to weaken the sovereign power is a greater crime in a professional lawyer than in another man. Also, an act against the law is a greater crime in a man with such a reputation for wisdom that his advice is taken or his actions imitated by many people than it would be in anyone else. For the former not only commits crime, but teaches it as law to everyone else. And generally all crimes are made greater by becoming stumbling blocks to weaker people who attend less to the path they are walking along than to the light that other men carry before them. Also, acts of hostility against the present state of the Commonwealth are greater crimes than the same acts performed against private men, because in the former case the damage spreads to everyone. Examples would be betraying the strengths or revealing the secrets of the Commonwealth to an enemy. Also, all attacks on the representative of the Commonwealth, whether monarch or assembly, and all attempts by word or deed to lessen the authority of the sovereign, whether the present sovereign or his successors. Similarly, crimes that subvert legal judgments are greater crimes than wrongs done to only a few individuals. For example, taking a bribe in return for giving a false judgment or false testimony is a greater crime than getting that much money or even more from someone through ordinary deception. This is because the bribe taker not only wrongs the person who loses by the corrupt judgment, but also potentially makes all judgments useless and opens the door to coercion and private revenges. Also, robbery and embezzlement of the public treasure or revenues is a greater crime than robbing or defrauding a private citizen, because to rob the public is to rob many people at once. Impersonating a public official, or counterfeiting public seals or public coins, is a worse crime than impersonating a private individual or counterfeiting his seal, because in the former case the fraud reaches out and harms many people. Of acts against the law done to private men, the crime is greater when the damage it does is greater according to the common opinion of men, and therefore to kill against the law is a greater crime than any other injury in which life is not taken. To kill while inflicting pain is greater than simply to kill. Mutilation of a limb is greater than robbing a man of his goods. Robbing a man of his goods by terror of death or wounds is greater than robbing him by clandestine theft. Clandestine theft is greater than theft through consent that was fraudulently obtained. The violation of chastity by force is greater than violation by flattery. Violation of a married woman is greater than violation of an unmarried woman, for that is the usual way of looking at this matter. Men will vary in the strength of their feelings about any given offence, but the law attends to the attitudes of mankind in general, ignoring individual variations. That is why the laws of the Greeks and Romans, and of other ancient and modern commonwealths, have paid no attention to the offence that men take from being insulted, in words or gestures, when they do no harm beyond the present anger or unhappiness of the insulted person. It has been supposed that the true cause of such unhappiness consists not in the insult, which gets no grip on someone conscious of his own virtue, but in the small-mindedness of the person who is offended by it. A crime against a private man can be made much worse by the person, time, and place. To kill one's parent is a greater crime than to kill someone else, because the parent ought to be honoured as a sovereign. He has surrendered his sovereignty to the civil law, but he did originally have it by nature. And to rob a poor man is a greater crime than to rob a rich one, because the poor man suffers more from the loss. And a crime committed at a time or in a place set aside for devotion is greater than if committed at another time or place, for it proceeds from a greater disregard for the law and for divine worship. Many other bases for aggravation and extenuation could be added, but the ones I have set down suffice to make it obvious to everyone how to estimate the depth of any other proposed crime. A final point. In most crimes, some private men are wronged, and so also is the Commonwealth. A single crime may be called a public crime, when the accusation is in the name of the Commonwealth, and a private crime when the accusation is in the name of a private man. Chapter 28. Punishments and Rewards. A punishment is an evil inflicted by public authority on someone who has done something that the public authority judges to be a breach of the law, inflicted for the purpose of making the will of men more disposed to obedience. Before I infer anything from this definition, a very important question must be answered. Through what door did the right or authority to punish come in? From what I have said, no man is bound by covenant not to resist violence, so no one can give anyone else the right to lay violent hands on his person. In the making of a commonwealth, every man gives away the right to defend others, but not the right to defend himself. Also, each man obliges himself to help the sovereign to punish others, but not to punish himself. But to covenant to help the sovereign to hurt someone else is not to give him a right to punish. So it's plain that the commonwealth's right to punish is not based on any concession or gift of the subjects. But I showed in chapter 14 that before the commonwealth is established, every man has a right to everything, and to do whatever he thinks necessary for his own preservation, subduing, hurting, or killing any man for that purpose. And this is the foundation of the right of punishing exercised in every commonwealth. For the subjects didn't give the sovereign that right, in laying down their right to hurt others, they merely strengthened the sovereign to use his own right, the right that he had already, in ways he thinks fit for the preservation of them all. So the right to punish was not given to him. He, and he alone, was left with it. And except for the limits set by natural law, he has retained it in its entirety, just as he had it in the raw condition of nature and of war of everyone against his neighbour. That completes my answer to the important preliminary question. From the definition of punishment, I infer first that neither private revenges nor harms done by private men can properly be called punishment, because they don't come from public authority. Secondly, that being neglected and given no kind of preference by the public authorities is not a punishment, because it merely leaves a man in the state he was in before. It doesn't inflict any new evil on him. Thirdly, that if the public authority inflicts an evil on a man without a prior public condemnation, that isn't to be called punishment. It is merely a hostile act, because the action for which a man is punished should first be judged by the public authority to be a breach of the law. Fourthly, that when evil is inflicted on someone by usurped power and by judges with no authority from the sovereign, that isn't punishment, but an act of hostility, because the acts of usurped power are not acts of the public authority. Fifthly, that evil inflicted on someone without an intention or a possibility of making him or, through this example, making other men more inclined to obey the law, isn't punishment, but an act of hostility, because the term punishment applies only to hurt done with that purpose. Sixthly, some bad actions are naturally followed by various consequences that are hurtful to the person himself, as when a man is killed or wounded in the course of assaulting someone else, or when he falls ill through the performance of some unlawful act. These hurts can be said to be divine punishment, because they are inflicted by God, the author of nature. But they don't fall under the scope of punishment, understood as a human procedure, because they aren't inflicted by the authority of man. Seventhly, if the harm inflicted is less than the benefit or contentment that naturally follows for the criminal from his crime, that harm does not fall within the definition of punishment, and is rather the price or the fee for committing the crime. That is because it is of the nature of punishment to be intended to deter men from breaking the law, and if the punishment is outweighed by the benefit of the crime, that purpose is not achieved. Quite the contrary, indeed. Eighthly, if a punishment is settled and prescribed in the law itself, and after a crime is committed, a greater punishment is inflicted, the extra part is not punishment, but an act of hostility. The purpose of punishment is not revenge, but deterrent terror, and the level of that was set by the declared lesser punishment. So piling on extra after the crime has been committed can't have had any power to deter that crime, and is therefore not part of the punishment. But when no punishment at all has been settled by the law, whatever is inflicted does have the nature of punishment. For someone who sets out to break a law, for which no penalty has been set, expects that if he is caught, he will receive a punishment devised for his particular case. Ninthly, harm inflicted for an act performed before there was a law forbidding it is not punishment, but an act of hostility. For punishment presupposes an act judged to have been a breach of the law, and there can't be a breach of a law that doesn't yet exist. Tenthly, hurt inflicted on the representative of the Commonwealth is not punishment, but an act of hostility, because it is of the nature of punishment to be inflicted by public authority, which is the authority of the representative itself. Finally, harm inflicted on declared enemies of the Commonwealth is not describable as punishment. Either they were never subject to the law, and therefore cannot break it, or they have been subject to it, but claim that they are no longer so, and therefore cannot break it. So any harms inflicted on them must be taken as acts of hostility. But when hostility has been declared, all infliction of harm is lawful. So if a subject by actions or words knowingly and deliberately denies the authority of the Commonwealth's representative, he may lawfully be made to suffer whatever the representative chooses to inflict, whatever penalty has been officially set for treason. For in denying that he is a subject, he implicitly denies that he is liable for the punishment ordained by the law, and therefore he suffers as an enemy of the Commonwealth. That is, he suffers whatever the representative chooses that he suffer. For the punishments set down in the law are for subjects, not for enemies such as those who, having become subjects by their own act, then deliberately revolted and denied the sovereign power. The first and most general classification of punishments is into divine and human. It will be more convenient to discuss the former later on. Human punishments are ones inflicted at the command of man, and are either corporal, or pecuniary, or disgrace, or imprisonment, or exile, or a mixture of these. Corporal punishment is the kind of harm that is, and is intended to be, inflicted on the body directly. For example, stripes left by a lash, or wounds, or deprivation of pleasures of the body that had previously been lawfully enjoyed. Some corporal punishments are capital, some less than capital. Capital punishment is the infliction of death, either done simply or accompanied by pain. Less than capital punishment includes stripes, wounds, chains, and any other corporal pain not in its own nature fatal. I say not in its own nature fatal, because if a punishment causes death, not intended by the inflictor, the punishment doesn't count as capital. The harm turned out to be fatal, but that was by an unforeseen accident. In such a case, death is not inflicted, but hastened. Pecuniary punishment may consist in depriving a man of a sum of money, but the deprivation may instead be of land or any other goods that are usually bought and sold for money. If the law ordaining such a punishment was established in order to get money from those who break that law, it's not really a punishment, but rather the price of privilege and exemption from the law. For the law doesn't absolutely forbid the act, but forbids it only to those unable to pay the money. Similarly, if the law requires that a sum of money be paid to someone who has been wronged, this is merely a satisfaction for the wrong done to him. It extinguishes his complaint, but not the offender's crime. Disgrace is the infliction of some evil that is made dishonourable by the Commonwealth, or the deprivation of some good that is made honourable by it. Some things are honourable by nature, such as the effects of courage, magnanimity, strength, wisdom, and other abilities of body and mind. They may fail by nature or by accident, but they can't be taken away by a law, so the loss of them isn't punishment. Others are made honourable by the Commonwealth, such as badges, titles, offices, or any other special mark of the sovereign's favour. They can be taken away by the public authority that made them honourable, and losses of them are properly punishments. For example, stripping convicted men of their badges, titles, and offices, or declaring them ineligible for such honours in the future. Imprisonment is when a man is deprived of liberty by the public authority, and this may happen for either of two purposes. One is to keep an accused man in custody, the other is to inflict hardship on a condemned man. The former isn't punishment, because no man is supposed to be punished before being judicially heard and declared guilty. So any hurt that a man is made to suffer by bonds or restraint before his trial, apart from what is needed to keep him in custody, is against the law of nature. But the latter is punishment, because it is an evil inflicted by the public authority for something that that same authority has judged to be a breach of the law. I count as imprisonment all restraint of motion caused by an external obstacle. The obstacle might be a building, which is called by the general name prison, or an island, to which men are said to be confined, or a place where men are set to work, quarries in ancient times, galleys these days, or a chain, or any other such impediment. Exile, banishment, is when a convicted man is condemned to leave the territory of the Commonwealth, or to keep out of a certain part of it, and, for a fixed time or for ever, not to return to it. Considered just in itself, this seems not to be a punishment, but rather an escape or a public command to avoid punishment by flight. Cicero says that such a punishment was never ordained in the city of Rome, and he calls it not a punishment, but a refuge for men in danger. For if a banished man is permitted still to enjoy his goods and the income from his lands, the mere change of air is no punishment. Nor does it tend to the benefit of the Commonwealth, for which all punishments are ordained, namely, shaping men's wills to obedience to the law. Indeed, it often tends to damage the Commonwealth by adding to the number of its enemies. For a banished man is a lawful enemy of the Commonwealth that drove him out, being no longer a member of it. If along with banishment he is deprived of his lands or goods, that is a real punishment. But then the punishment lies not in the exile, but in the loss of material, and should be counted as a pecuniary punishment. All punishments of innocent subjects, great or small, are against the law of nature, for punishment is only for breaking the law, so there can be no punishment of the innocent. But the infliction of any evil whatsoever on an innocent man who isn't a subject, if it's for the benefit of the Commonwealth and doesn't violate any former covenant, is no breach of the law of nature. For all men who are not subjects are enemies, unless previous covenants have ended their enmity. And it's lawful, by the basic right of nature, for the Commonwealth to make war against enemies who it thinks could harm it. And in war, the sword makes no judgments, and the winner does not distinguish the guilty from the innocent, as regards the past, or consider mercy on any basis except what conduces to the good of his own people in the future. This is why vengeance is lawfully extended not only to subjects who deliberately deny the authority of the established Commonwealth, but also to their fathers, and to their descendants to the third and fourth generation, even though these don't yet exist, and are consequently innocent of the rebellious act for which they are afflicted. It is because rebellion consists in the renouncing of the role of subject, which is a relapse into the condition of war, and those who offend in that way suffer not as subjects but as enemies, for rebellion is simply renewed war. Rewards are of two kinds, either of gift or by contract. Reward by contract is called salary and wages, which is benefit due for services performed or promised. Reward of gift is benefit that comes from the grace of those who give it, to encourage or enable men to do them service. The sovereign can fairly use the resources of all subjects, and those who defend the Commonwealth, having set aside their own affairs, ought to be compensated from those resources, so that the lowest of soldiers can demand the wages of his service as a thing owed by right. If a sovereign bestows benefits on a subject out of fear of his harming the Commonwealth, these are not properly rewards, for they are not salaries, because in this case no contract is involved, every man being obliged already not to harm the Commonwealth. Nor are they graces, that is, rewards of gift, because they are extorted by fear. Rather, they are sacrifices, which the sovereign, considered as an individual, and not as personifying the Commonwealth, makes to appease the discontent of someone he thinks to be more powerful than himself. Such sacrifices don't encourage subjects to be obedient. On the contrary, they encourage the continuance and increasing of extortion. And that is all I need to say about the nature of punishment and reward, which are, as it were, the nerves and tendons that move the limbs and joints of a Commonwealth. Up to here, I have set forth the nature of man, whose pride and other passions have compelled him to submit himself to government, together with the great power of his governor, whom I compared to Leviathan. I take that comparison from the book of Job, where God, having described the great power of Leviathan, calls him King of the Proud. He says, "There is nothing on earth to be compared with him. He is made so as not to be afraid. He sees every high thing below him, and is king of all the children of pride." But because he is mortal, and subject to decay, as all other earthly creatures are, and because there is in heaven, though not on earth, someone he should stand in fear of, and whose laws he ought to obey, I shall now speak of Leviathan's diseases, and the causes of his mortality, and of what laws of nature he is bound to obey. End of chapter 28.